Good morning. You're listening to KRTS Marfa Public Radio. This is A Talk at 10. I am your host, Tim Johnson, and my guest this morning is Rebecca Solnit, the San Francisco-based writer and activist who will be in town in Marfa this weekend for the Marfa Dialogues, which are presented by Ballroom Marfa and the Washington Spectator. It will be a free public symposium on climate change, sustainability, and art, and there will be speakers at primarily at the Crowley Theater, but also at the Marfa Book Company on Saturday and Sunday, and there will also be an art opening at the Ballroom on Friday evening. Rebecca, thanks for joining me this morning.
My pleasure.
So there's a lot of things I'd like to address, but we'll see what we can get in 25 minutes. The subject of this symposium, for which you're a participant, is climate change and sustainability. I feel like, for better or worse, it's probably worth our while to address the subject of climate change because despite the broad consensus in the scientific world, it's still a sort of contested field in the general world of everyone else. So how do you think of the sort of situation of the climate at this moment?
You know, people were talking until very recently as though climate change was a terrible thing that might happen, but it's pretty clear that climate change is here. You look at all the records, the tens of thousands of heat records that were broken this year. You look at the massive drought. You look at the fact that barges are running aground in the middle of the Mississippi because it's so dry from this drought. You look at unprecedented melting of the ice, a lack of summer sea ice. And it's just so clear climate change is here. And there's two real questions. One is, what are we going to do about it? Keep it from getting worse, and two is how do we adapt to a much more chaotic, turbulent, and essentially hostile planet that we're already on. You know, as for the people who don't believe in it, it's we should have acted on all this 30 years ago. We knew 30 years ago. We knew 20 years ago. We knew 10 years ago, but it would require making some profound changes, and the oil companies in particular stood to lose. And so they funded the climate denialists and corrupted a small minority of scientists who tried to make it seem like there was doubt or controversy or uncertainty when the consensus was pretty certain. And the tragic thing is we're talking about the fate of the whole world and every living thing on it, from coral reefs and Arctic animals to human beings just about everywhere, and we've gambled that away so that for a very short period of time, a lot of people who are so rich they couldn't possibly need any more get a little bit richer.
You've written on Tom Dispatch, which is an online sort of journal which is supported by the Nation Institute, in the past that, you know, these disaster movies that we sort of have lived with in this country for a long time, they might have been bad art, but now they seem like good prophecy in some ways. But that in those films, primarily you have, you know, a sort of president character, someone very charismatic, who's able to rally the people and they come to some solution. But in, you write that in the present state of affairs, it's as if the presidents have sided with the aliens or with whatever the big negative force is, which you sort of align with the corporation.
I have. You know, in so many of those disaster and sci-fi movies, they pretend to scare us, but they really reassure us, because what they tell us is that, you know, trust authority, the people in charge will save us. The machismo of Charlton Heston is just what we need, or the machismo of Tom Cruise or whoever stars in disaster movies nowadays. And it really reinforces a very conventional and really authoritarian picture of human nature. You know, ordinary people are panicking, particularly if they're my gender. They're generally running around like headless chickens, screaming and becoming burdens and risks for other people. And your gender, they're generally raping, pillaging, and looting, you know, or stampeding over each other. And that's a picture of human nature in which the many are out of control. They need authoritarians to tell them what to do. They're helpless, they're clueless, and the authorities are trustworthy. In fact, when you look at actual disasters, And we're talking now as a hurricane's approaching Katrina, 7 years after our authorities failed us so badly in that disaster. And most ordinary people did pretty well. So when you look at what actually happens, ordinary people are actually pretty calm, resourceful, creative, and extraordinarily generous and altruistic towards the people around them. I think that's real human nature. And some of us are corrupted. And in fact, the people who often have the most power are the most corrupted. And two things happen. One is that they often act to consolidate their own power. Another is that they tend to believe what disaster movies believe, which is that the rest of us are out of control, that we're not the public, we're a danger to the public. And they focus on controlling us. This is why the governor of Louisiana 7 years ago said, we have troops fresh from Iraq, and they have M16s that are locked and loaded, and they know how to use them. This is what she was offering to send to the devastated people of New Orleans, including, you know, people dying of heat stroke on roofs and elevated freeway overpasses, you know, hungry, dehydrated little children, people going without their meds, etc. You know, she saw them as people who needed to be controlled, not as, you know, people who we should feel the deep kinship with and try to help. And so the authorities often misbehave. And I think when you look at climate change also, the great majority of people in this country as well as elsewhere want to make changes. Just after 9/11, people were really ready to reexamine our relationship with the rich oil-producing countries in the Middle East and elsewhere and rethink our energy policy. And the government said, don't change anything. We'll just bomb them. So, you know, the real obstacle, the meteor streaming towards us that's colliding with the Earth or collided with the Earth, is the people, and, you know, is the most powerful people, is the oil corporations that essentially have enough reserves of petroleum to raise the temperature of the Earth enough degrees to guarantee, you know, every possible kind of disaster. And then you look at the summit in Copenhagen a couple of years ago, the summit in Rio this summer, and you see just the complete lack of will on the part of most of the governments on Earth to do things that their citizens want them to do. So it's important, I think, for people to keep in mind that we're not the problem, and that, you know, that the problem is the people who benefit most from the status quo are least willing to change it, and that climate change requires profound changes in the status quo.
You've written in most recently in a book called A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster, that despite this kind of, like, what we call a Hobbesian model of humanity, one which is, like, very violently seeking its own ends, despite that sort of idea which we live with, which is presented to us as our nature so regularly, that in, as you've mentioned, in the context of these disasters, people often in mass behave very differently. They have a sort of sense of the mutual aid, or a communal sense of a shared experience of this disaster and a shared responsibility for coping with it and for surviving and for moving on. And that's definitely not one that we ordinarily see through the media. When you talk now about, you know, the narrative that we're not getting, or the narrative that we're getting about climate change through the media, do you see any, like, sort of communal organizations underneath this that are taking place in some ways analogous to what happens in disasters in maybe preparation or in relationship to climate change?
You know, you can think of you can look at the economic disaster that we underwent in 2008 that's ongoing for most people in this country and elsewhere, and see the Occupy movement, for example, as a kind of emergency encampment that looked strangely for me like the way people camp out after earthquakes and hurricanes and things like that, where the housing is gone and you improvise community kitchens, community shelters, you live in tents. And in that time, you find out what you have in common with people and often feel such a deep sense of common bonds and common dreams that it's often a very weirdly positive experience, even though there's also loss, there's also suffering, there's also the closeness of death. You know, this is not my opinion. This is based on many hundreds of sociologists studying what happens in the aftermath of disasters for all the years since World War II, and pretty universally reaching these conclusions that actually most of us rise to the occasion pretty beautifully in disaster. And we've always been told that in disaster we revert to our original nature, and that original nature is selfish, it's chaotic, it's not so bright, it's not so strategic, it's not so generous. And I don't know if we really revert to our original nature in disaster, but if that's what we do, that original nature is something completely different. It's always interesting talking about these things, because my book's about urban disaster, talking about these things to rural people, because in a way, I don't think it's a disaster in the sense of chaos, but there's a lot of resource demands. You know, your neighbor's got the guy who's got the snowplow attachment for his truck. You know, you guys might figure out what to do together when the mills stop pumping water or there's a fire. I think a lot of rural people are actually really used to cooperating and collaborating, even with people who might think really differently. You know, like you're a liberal, your neighbor's a Pentecostal, and there's the Mormons down the road, and you're all going to fight the same fire, and the differences don't matter that much in that moment when, you know, a prairie fire comes at you or some other kind of disaster. So I think that we're facing all kinds of disaster. A lot of it is here in this country now, heat waves, droughts, forest fires, hurricanes, et cetera, that you know, very much correlate to the arrival of climate change. And people are doing what they've always done. What's interesting is that both in the short term of surviving a particular disaster brought about by climate change and in the long-term disaster that climate change is going to be, I think that people will improvise in many ways and respond, you know, for the most part altruistically to the situation, particularly in the short term. In the long term, you know, nobody wakes up in the morning and just, you know, no ordinary citizen wakes up in the morning and says, I think it would be great to wage war on the country next to us. I think it would be great to see them starve while we monopolize the resources. And, you know, those are the results of long political machinations and propaganda campaigns and things. It's pretty hard to convince people that they want war and that it's in their interest. I think there's going to be wars associated with climate change, resource wars around water and food as well as around energy. And who we think we are and what we think we're capable of and what we define as our interest is going to be very important in that. Politics always grows out of culture. Politics is based on beliefs. And so what you believe is really important. And I wrote A Paradise Built in Hell to give people some resources about who we might really be and how things might really work. And I think of that as part of disaster preparedness as much as the kind of earthquake kit we're supposed to have here in San Francisco, you know, flashlights and batteries and emergency radios and water and things like that. And, you know, and those of you who grew up as Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts got that be prepared. And there's all kinds of practical ways to be prepared. But knowing what to expect and thinking deeply about who we are, who you're going to trust, on really looking at how your local and regional and maybe national government is going to behave, are also part of being prepared.
You're listening to KRTS Marfa Public Radio. This is a Talk at 10 with the writer and activist Rebecca Solnit, who will be a part of this weekend's Marfa Dialogues, which is presented by Ballroom Marfa and the Washington Spectator with special support from Marfa Public Radio and the Marfa Book Company. You've just mentioned this, a sort of bleak future, which would involve wars over resources such as water and energy, and a sense of preparedness, which we need to sort of develop on different sort of local and state and regional sort of levels. This particular weekend, you'll be on a panel talking with a number of artists who are, in their own ways, addressing climate change and sustainability. You're a person also who has written quite a lot about interrelationships of land rights and art and activism and all sorts of things. You know, do you have what sort of role do you see for art or for creativity in this situation?
I think one of the things that climate change has been so hard to respond to because it's very conceptual. You know, you can't say this hurricane or this heat wave is exactly because of. You can just look at the macro pattern. I think it's really about giving people frameworks for thinking about something like this, images of it. And I think also hope is important. You know, I wrote a book about hope before I wrote a book about disaster, and they have a lot in common. I think that, you know, a lot of that, we're in a very difficult era, but it's really like Hurricane Katrina. You know, there are people who say, like, oh, we can't do anything because we can't save everybody. But you can't, you can never save anybody. But a lot of people weren't hopeless, and they went into those that flooded city 7 years ago this week, and they pulled, you know, they rescued 3 people or 112 people or 372 people. You know, there's a lot we can still do, whether it's about adapting on a small scale or participating in the global movement to try and limit the amount we raise the temperature and the amount that all the systems therefore go haywire. And, you know, and we also often talk about political engagement as though it's a really kind of dreary and miserable thing. But I think it's a really beautiful and honorable way to live, and that's also something worth talking about and worth representing. What do we want in our lives? Who are we? What are the most meaningful things we could be doing? Who do we? What do we want to connect to most deeply? You know, we live in a very commercial culture that's always telling us we need more stuff and really kind of isolating and alienating us a lot by keeping us busy with the internet and consuming and paying for all that junk and, you know, all the kinds of insecurity that go with that. And I think that one of the things artists do, and by artists I mean everybody doing something creative, whether they're doing radio programs or journalism or visual art, and really, you know, I'd broaden that to include education and conversation and, you know, being a preacher or minister or priest, and we're all engaged in a profound conversation. That's what culture always is, and contributing creatively to that conversation about who we are, providing alternative pictures and narratives to the really kind of tragically reduced version of who we are we get from television and advertising that we have, you know, that doesn't tell us we have a soul, that doesn't tell us we have citizens, that don't tell us how big and deep our experience can be and ourselves can be. You know, I think that's a lot of the real work that we all have to do, you know, along, and maybe be playful or funny or witty, you know, or caustic while we're doing it, you know, or profound or poetic.
Sure. You've written that a quote that which is actually on the Ballroom site, which is sort of in keeping what you've just said, which I thought was really interesting, was public life enlarges you, gives you purpose and context, saves you from drowning in the purely personal, as so many Americans seem to. This is something which I think probably a lot of people can identify with, this idea of the purely personal.
To be human can be very broad in the way you connect to so many forces and people and communities and possibilities around you. And I think it can be very deep. And sometimes we call that spirituality or religion or having a soul. You know, it can also be a sense of deep time and deep history. One of the things I love about New Orleans, you know, this week of Katrina, New Orleans, the city I've gotten to know so well, is that people live that way. They talk to strangers, they live in public, they celebrate a lot, but also they remember. And many of them know where their great-grandparents lived. They know the people around them. They know the history of the city. And so in some ways, they seem to have lives that are broad and deep. In a way, a lot of us don't. You know, I don't think West Texas is necessarily one of those places, but a lot of Americans are living in these kind of suburbanized, privatized lives where you don't have a lot of contact with the people around you. You don't have a lot of deep connections to your community, to the institutions. You don't have real political engagement. You often don't feel like you have power. And part of why people trivialize their lives is that they don't know there's an alternative, that you have real power, that you can be connected. You know, and those are not the things given to us by the most powerful and obvious and loud institutions. Those are the alternatives, whether you find them through your church or your Occupy encampment, or the conversation with the people at your university, or with your neighbors, or just by thinking deeply and paying attention closely to what's around you. A lot of what artists do is help us pay attention often to what becomes invisible because it's so familiar. They help us see fresh. They're kind of the strangers who arrive and say, hey, this is really weird, or why is it this way? It could be this other way, or who does this serve? You know, and artists have become kind of professional amateurs, offering us that freshness, that surprisingness. But, you know, I think that's part of the project, of keeping us reminded how broad and deep our lives can be, how many other ways there are to be, how much of us there is that might not be addressed by commercial and consumer culture, and by the kind of trivialization of everyday life we get from the mainstream media, advertising, etc.
You're listening to Rebecca Solnit on KRTS Marfa Public Radio. Rebecca will be speaking at the Marfa Book Company this Sunday at 1 p.m. as a part of the Marfa Dialogues. She will also be on a panel with a number of other artists on Saturday at 1 p.m. at the Crowley Theater. Both of those events, as are all of the other events of the Marfa Dialogues, are free, and the seating is available first come, first served. We expect this will be a pretty popular group of talks, so if you're interested in the individual ones, we recommend that you come early. Rebecca, you've written really beautifully about the American West and the deserts of the American West. Have you ever been to this part of the High Chihuahuan Desert?
Yeah, I've passed through it three times and never spent enough time there. It's just incredibly beautiful. I love vastness and openness and that kind of rolling space. I spend as much time as I can in Nevada and New Mexico, too. So I'm really thrilled to be coming to Marfa, and someday I'll come back for longer. I also have to say, I love the movie Giant. I've watched it a lot. I can recite some of Elizabeth Taylor's dialogue from memory, and I love it as, you know, a sweeping saga of the American West that's also a pretty radical screed about race, class, and gender, with a really powerful woman in really sexy jodhpurs at the center of it all. But, you know, it's a really fun movie, so I'm stoked about that aspect of Marfa.
There's a small museum for the film here in downtown Marfa, too, which you'll have to see while you're visiting.
Yeah, I look forward to that and to the whole thing. And to the bookstore. I don't know if you mentioned I'm also reading on Sunday at the bookstore in Marfa.
Yes, ma'am, absolutely. We look forward to it. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
You've been tuned in to a Talk at 10 on Marfa Public Radio. Our guest this morning was Rebecca Solnit, a San Francisco-based writer known for her diverse areas of expertise and advocacy of environmental and human rights causes. She is the author of 13 books, including most recently A Paradise Built in Hell and Hope in the Dark. She also won a National Book Critics Circle Award for her book Rivers of Time, Edward Muybridge, and the Technological Wild West. She'll be speaking at the Crowley Theater this Saturday at 1 p.m. and then again at the Marfa Book Company at 1 p.m. on Sunday. She'll also be at the Marfa Book Company this Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. signing copies of the book Crazy from the Heat, A Chronicle of 20 Years in the Big Bend, a photographic survey of the work of James Evans, for which she wrote the introduction.